The second case for oral argument this morning is Joshua John Armstrong, appellant versus the State of South Dakota Appellee. For the appellant, we have Mr. N. Bob Pizal, an attorney from Flandreau, and for the appellee, we have Mr. Frank Geegan, an assistant attorney general from Pierre. Mr. Pizal, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
As the Chief Justice indicated, my name is Bob Pizal from Flandreau. I'll be delivering remarks today on behalf of Joshua John Armstrong. May they please the court.
Counsel?
Essentially, what we've got in this situation is a case where Mr. Armstrong has been convicted of sexual contact with a person under the age of 16. He went through a jury trial in this case, and at the jury trial, there were three evidentiary issues that we challenge. Those give rise to this appeal. Those issues involve the admission of evidence relating to a conviction that Mr. Armstrong had in 1999, a rape conviction, some statements that he made while he was in prison in 2003 in a counseling session, and the court's exclusion of cross-examination of the alleged victim, R.A., regarding incidents that took place in her life in 1998. I should correct, for the record, the notes regarding the age of the defendant in the brief. He was born in 1975, so with respect to the rape conviction in 99, he was 22 years old. I think I put 21. In order to understand that the issues that we take with respect to these three pieces of evidence, I have to give a little bit of background. Mr. Armstrong was married to one of the witnesses, Tracy Armstrong. They got married in 1994. They had a child, R.A. She is the alleged victim in this case, in 1995. In 1996, Mr. Armstrong got involved in a burglary conviction. He was on federal supervised release in 1997 when he went to this beer party. He got drunk. He encountered a young lady at the beer party who was also drunk and 15 years old at the time. They had sex, and this resulted in the 1999 conviction for rape. While he was in prison, he participated in a counseling program. This was a group counseling program addressing the offender cycle. It was supervised by a counselor named Sheila Queso. During that counseling session, Mr. Armstrong made statements regarding his belief that it was man's law, not God's law, that prohibited the sexual encounter that he had had, and made some statements regarding when he thought a person ought to be sexually available. With respect to the third issue, the alleged victim in this case has been the victim of criminal sexual contact at least twice in her life outside of this case. The event that we wanted to raise on cross-examination at trial dealt with her having been the victim of sexual contact in 1998. I'll start by addressing the 1999 conviction. This is a prior bad act situation, and essentially what we have in 1999 is a case where Mr. Armstrong went to a beer party, got drunk, and engaged in the encounters I've described. The state asked to bring this up at trial in order to prove intent or lack of mistake as a prior bad act. It's our position that there isn't any connection that would make this evidence relevant to the question of mistake or intent. Now, the legal standards that we go into at length in the briefs, and we focus heavily on the State versus Chamley case, require a number of things. First of all, you've got to have some relevance. You've got to have a factual connection between the two cases. And the position that we're taking with respect to the 1999 conviction is that in 1999, Joshua Armstrong had this sexual encounter with a woman who was 7 years younger than him at a beer party. In 2009, he's accused of having had intentional sexual contact with his daughter. There's no beer party in the 2009 case. There's no religious discussion in the 1997 case. There's no relationship between the parties in 1997. There is in 2009. There's simply no real factual correlation between the two cases that we think allows for any sort of an inference that would make a fact of consequence in this case more or less likely.
Well, isn't it more about the fact that as an adult,
at a minimum of 22 years old, that he apparently had been involved in sexual contact with 13 and 15 year old children. I mean, isn't that the purpose of the offer to then to rebut the defense that this was an innocent touching?
There wasn't a defense that the touch. Let me back up. In the defense at trial, we didn't raise the argument that the touching of the breasts or butt or private areas took place. Rather, we took the position that any touching that took place was completely innocent and didn't come into contact with that.
Well, it was a hug. As I read it, there was something about it was an innocent hug or something like that.
Essentially, that's how the testimony given by the DCI officer described it. Mr. Armstrong never took the stand and did not testify in this case.
So what was the defense then, precisely?
Essentially, the defense in this case was that the child's interpretation of what took place was wrong and that her imagination ran away with her.
So why wouldn't that bring in the absence of mistake, the question about, because if the jury then is left to decide, was this an innocent or you're essentially admitting some touching. The question is, was it innocent or not?
The absence of mistake with respect to the prior conviction, again, there's a lack of a connection there. The person testifying is the person we're asking in this scenario whether they're making a mistake. R.A. didn't have any knowledge of the facts that took place back in 1997 with respect to this statutory rape conviction. If there was to be an absence of mistake, I think it would have to be a mistake on the part of the defendant, whether his touching was by mistake rather than a mistaken interpretation by the alleged victim.
Right, right, of course. Yeah, his misunderstood touching. And why wouldn't the prior act of sex with another child go toward the question of whether his touching was innocent or not innocent?
Outside of evidence of his character and propensity, I don't think there's any connection because there's no factual relationship between the two cases. The state even indicated this in its argument to admit the evidence that it was being offered to show that he was not adverse to this sort of thing. And I think that's exactly the sort of, that's the one thing that our 404B rule actually excludes.
That's clearly propensity. I mean, he's arguing for that. But so I'm curious about that. Here, it's the prosecutor is arguing clearly for a propensity. How does it get changed into absence of mistake and identity? Is that the trial judge then refashioning the reason for it, or did the prosecutor argue that?
Prosecutor mentioned one of the grounds that he was offering it for as mistake, the other as this propensity, during the arguments on the prosecutor's motion to admit the evidence. If memory serves, when we actually got to trial, the jury instruction boiled down to absence of mistake. I think this was a decision that was made by the trial judge, and I think it honestly is abuse of discretion in this case because that connection is not there.
So identity didn't go to the jury then?
No, there was no challenge as to identity. All the parties agreed that he was
right,
there.
Okay. So, the prior act, though, the judge did not instruct the jury that you can consider this prior act on the issue of identity?
Not to my recollection, no.
Okay.
How about intent?
I'm sorry?
How about intent? Did the judge just use that as a basis for sending it to the jury?
If memory serves, the jury instruction with respect to the prior acts only addressed absence of mistake. The other problem that we have with this 1999 conviction is the way in which the state presented it. And we go into it at length in the brief, but essentially what happened is this. The state was aware that the prior conviction was out there in March. The conviction is described at length in the habitual offender information in this case. The trial court set a deadline for giving notice of intent to offer other acts and a deadline for filing pretrial motions no later than May 19th for the hearing date on giving notice. The state didn't give notice of its intent to offer this act until June 23rd. So we're more than a month after the deadline that this notice and this motion to admit the other act's evidence is filed. This comes on for a hearing on June 30th. We're now 9 days before trial with an intervening holiday, July 4th, in the middle there. And the court, without having any cause given, decides that that evidence is going to be allowed anyway.
Did you move for a continuance?
The court suggested moving for a continuance. We didn't do so because Mr. Armstrong had been in jail since February 20th already. He was anxious to get his trial conducted. And I think, honestly, that raises a legitimate speedy trial question if he would be compelled to simply delay his own trial due to the mistakes that the state had made. Lacking a more articulate legal explanation, telling someone that the state made a mistake and didn't bother to file the paperwork it needed to file in time, your remedy is to stay in jail longer, that doesn't pass the smell test.
But how does it prejudice you that the court heard this and allowed it late?
The admission of the evidence over and against the rules is abuse of discretion, I think, in and of itself. As far as prejudice, a number of the cases out there, and again, we defer to Chamley, make it clear that any prior acts evidence is inherently prejudicial. I think the judge, in reviewing whether the evidence would be admitted, even ruled that this was prejudicial evidence.
I don't mean that. I understand that. But, I mean, why is the late request prejudicial to you, the late request to offer this bad acts?
I guess there are two reasons that one could address on that. Number one, it forced Mr. Armstrong to remain in custody longer than he might otherwise have had to, which was essentially depriving him of essential rights or even the ability to more fully participate in his defense. Number two, it gave us 9 days to try and do as much background work as we might have chosen to do in order to gather witnesses related to this prior conviction, to find the former victim, whose location to me is still unknown, and perhaps bring those people in. There simply wasn't an opportunity there given the intervening holiday.
But you allege that somehow deprived you of some evidence. That's not been raised in your brief.
No, we're not alleging that deprived us of evidence so much as we are alleging that it essentially would have deprived him of his right to a speedy trial. In addition, it also simply violated the statute, and we think that an illegal order by the judge ought to be remanded and corrected. The result of that illegal order was the introduction of evidence on the part of the state that was prejudicial to Mr. Armstrong.
Why was this illegal?
Because it was offered, the 404B motion was offered after the order was already in place.
The judge set the original date. Are you arguing the judge doesn't have authority to change his own order?
Not if there's no cause shown. I think 23A89 actually says that if a motion or a notice that's required to be given under that order is not done in a timely fashion, it is waived. However, the court has the authority to give relief from that waiver for cause shown.
So if I'm a street smart judge in the future, I don't set any deadlines. Then I don't get into this trouble.
Potentially, yes. And I know that there
are
judges...
That doesn't make a lot of sense for arguing due process.
Essentially.
I'm going to take you back one more time to the admission and the degree of similarity. You know, in State versus Wright, we said that the degree of similarity is dependent upon the purpose for which it's offered. And you're correct. In many of the cases, we've required a lot of similarity because it's going to the question of identity, which is MO or modus operandi, and therefore it's got to be quite similar to make the connection. But here, as you indicate now, under the jury instructions, it didn't go for identity. So the degree of similarity, it would seem to me, is not the kind it's not required to the degree that maybe you've expressed by arguing Chamley and Moeller in some of those cases.
I would submit that in this case there is very little similarity apart from the identity of the defendant or the age of the alleged victim. Beyond that, there are no corresponding circumstances by which a rational judicial mind can connect one to the other. I don't think, while admittedly there is some similarity, I don't think there's even enough to make it relevant to absence of mistake, particularly where the mistake in question would be a mistake by the alleged victim rather than mistaken conduct by the defendant.
Also, I'm still a little confused that the state indicates that the judge at some point, when the judge made the decision to allow it in, said that he was going to allow it in to show intent to have contact or sexual gratification. Yet you're saying the jury instruction only instructed the jury that they could consider it for mistake or accident. So it was your understanding that in the final analysis, the court did not submit it to the jury or give them an instruction that they could consider it for purposes of intent?
To my recollection, that is correct. We rely largely on the same arguments with respect to the 2003 statements. Again, what you've gotten in this case is a situation where the defendant made these statements totally out of context and in no relationship to the events that took place on February 19th of last year. When he made these inflammatory statements about when it's okay to have sex, he was in prison in a group counseling discussion with other sex offenders, and they were addressing their personal issues on the subject. There's not even a victim to describe in this case, much like the prior issues with respect to proof of character. We think the only reason that this is offered and the only use that could be made of it is to allege that this is a bad, creepy guy and that he's the sort of person who would do this. We don't think that's remotely appropriate under the case, and there's just no relevance or connection to it. The other side of the same coin is other inmates are going to hear the decision that the court makes in this case. If we tell inmates participating in these programs that what they say could be hauled out and used against them years later, out of context, in a criminal case, that's going to have a severe chilling effect on the treatment and rehabilitation efforts that we're making. I think based on both of those grounds that, again, you've got an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial court to admit this.
Well, the legislature defines privileges in this state. They recognize them with doctors and therapists. They certainly haven't in a prison setting, have they?
Could you repeat the question?
The legislature defines privileges in this state. They're statutory.
Yes.
All right. They've recognized privileges between a patient and a doctor, a patient and a psychiatrist, a patient and a therapist. Is there any statutory recognition of a privilege for these comments made in a prison setting?
I'm not aware of any statutory privilege that would protect these statements. Our argument basically boils down to relevance. There's, again, no connection between the conduct of the statements in this case and what may have taken place on February 19th of 2009. Mr. Armstrong wasn't in there saying, when I get out, I'm going to do this bad stuff. He wasn't even expressing a preference. All he's doing is saying some creepy stuff, which I think essentially was basically him trying to justify his old conduct in front of fellow inmates. Lastly, we have concerns with respect to the 1998 incident. The truth of the matter is that the alleged victim in this case has had a rather tragic life. She has been the victim of criminal sexual contact twice. Once was in 1998, that was at the hands of her uncle, and once was in 2007, that was at the hands of her mother's then boyfriend, Obang Ojele. The court considered his appeal, I think, 2 years ago, as a matter of fact. Chamley indicates that the credibility of the alleged victim is paramount in a sex crimes case, and I think there's an intrinsic value in knowing all of this young lady's background. The jury wasn't allowed to do that because we were not allowed to cross-examine on the 1998 incident with her uncle and how that would have affected her. The jury is essentially called upon in this case to listen to what she has to say. Keep in mind, this is a girl who believes that she was the victim of sexual contact. At the same time, she also was seeing dragons coming out of the walls. So there's serious questions about her ability to distinguish fact from reality.
You indicated that essentially the issue put in front of the jury was mistake. How was that put to the jury when your client didn't testify? What was the evidence that raised that issue?
If memory serves, the way that we addressed the question of mistake to the jury was essentially to say, look, when you have the testimony of one individual in a case where there is no physical evidence, no witnesses, and that individual is somebody who sits on the stand and says, I see things regularly that, as far as I know at least, are not there, this cannot raise to level of proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, if there was touching that took place, the only mistake that would arise out of that would be her mistake as to where the contact was or the nature of that contact.
Did he say something, though, to law enforcement or someone that this was a misunderstanding, that he was only giving her a hug?
He may have said that during his interview with the DCI agents while he was in custody. I don't recall his exact words.
Okay. So certainly that puts in issue the question of what is, whether it was, what kind of touching it was, innocent or not.
Potentially, but he didn't testify at trial to that effect.
But certainly the jury could hear what what he told law enforcement, though. The jury heard that, didn't it?
Yes, the jury heard what law enforcement recalled from his situation. I see I'm out of time. Based on the arguments, we think there's abuse of discretion on all of these matters and would invite a new trial.
On this last point, though, just one last thing. I understand in your opening statement, though, you raised the issue of mistake.
If memory serves, I inquired as to the encouraged the jury to look at whether or not this was a mistake or a cry for attention. But again, that would be a mistake on the part of RA.
Thank you, Mr. Pizzo. Mr. Deegan, you have 20 minutes. And I'll ask you right from the get-go, what does that instruction say? Does it say mistake or does it include intent?
I believe the instruction used the pattern language off the statute, 1912.5, as far as the admissible purpose which other acts of evidence can be used. But I believe the instruction also specifically went on based on a defense that was presented by the defendant regarding the alleged touch, or excuse me, not the alleged touching. He admitted to the touching, but alleged in opening and closing statements that he was merely attempting to comfort the child, and it was through no fault of his that the child didn't know how to handle or respond to a loving hug. So the jury specifically was admonished that the prior conviction could only be used to show the absence of mistake or accident, and they could not consider it in any way whatsoever as evidence of the defendant's guilt.
So I'm not sure of your answer. So absence of mistake or accident was really the only 403B, 404B type reason for letting it. Yeah, it was the only instruction given to the.
No, I believe that the pattern jury instruction, and I can't be positive because I don't have the subtle record in front of me, but I believe the court also gave the pattern jury instruction with reference to 1912.5, the other act statute.
All the reasons set
right.
forward.
Okay. And I believe the court also gave a clarifying instruction specifically with regard to absent mistake or accidents and admonished the jury that could not consider it as evidence of the defendant's guilt.
So how old was this child when she testified here, or when this happened?
The child was 15 years old at the time of the incident in question. It happened in February of 2009, okay. Shortly after the defendant had been released from prison, where he had finished serving a 10-year sentence for third-degree rape.
And then she testifies that he touched her breasts. And then, according to the transcript that have been attached here, she evidently circles other areas with a pen on an exhibit. Is that correct?
Exactly. She testified that he fondled her breast, and he also touched her in the vaginal area, as well as on the buttocks, when she was interviewed by Child Services.
So those other three areas, that's what she was talking
yes.
about.
As indicated earlier, the incident question happened back in February 2009, shortly after the defendant had been released from prison. Following a welcome home supper for the defendant at his mother's house, the defendant went with his ex-wife along with her four young children, to her house. Okay, the record shows, however, that he ended up spending the night on the couch. When asked if the defendant had made any attempts that evening to hook up with her, he traced the defendant's ex-wife, and the victim's mother indicated, yeah, but we didn't do anything. I didn't want to. The defendant readily admitted he was very candid with law enforcement when he was interviewed and told them that he had used, and I quote, every line he had in his book to get that to happen, but it didn't. The state would submit that not having much luck or success with his ex-wife, the defendant then turned his attention toward the victim. The record reflects that the following evening, the defendant was also allowed to spend a night with his ex-wife's house. At some point that evening, the victim was asked by her mother to go upstairs and retrieve some pajamas for her younger sister. The defendant followed the victim upstairs, and he told his ex-wife that he wanted to talk to his daughter. He later told law enforcement that the victim wanted to talk to him since she hadn't seen her father for so long due to the fact that he was in prison. While upstairs talking to his daughter, the defendant told her about his religion and his purported dream that he supposedly had, where he saw the victim laying naked on a table. It was approximately at that point in time the defendant started to fondle the victim's breast, and also touched her vaginal area. While he was doing so, the defendant told the victim, and I quote, she had a special thing or gift that his dragons wanted from her, and that she could protect her younger sisters from these dragons if she simply agreed to take off her clothes. The defendant then tried to convince the victim that it was okay for parents to do bad things to their children. The victim testified, and again I quote, he promised he didn't make my bedtime later if I let him do these bad things to me. Now, when the defendant was later interviewed by law enforcement, he did indeed admit to the touching, but maintained that his only attempt to comfort or console his daughter.
Let me just ask you then, you're going through a lot of the evidence. If that 404B of the prior incident was inadmissible, is it prejudicial at this point, or was there overwhelming testimony otherwise?
Absolutely not. It was not prejudicial. In addition to the victim's testimony, in reference to the defendant's statements, the defendant completely overlooks in his brief and during oral arguments the rather incriminating statements he had made to his own mother. The defendant's mother was called to testify.
No law came in.
Right. The defendant's mother was called to testify at trial and testified that the defendant was very angry, very upset with her. He had written her a letter in which he threatened that if he's going to go down for this, he's going to take her down with him. In that letter, the defendant also asked his mother to take the victim to see his attorney so she could tell him something. The defendant then instructed his mother in the letter to tell the victim that if she went and talked to his attorney and told him that she had lied about this incident in question, then the dragons would go away. So the state would submit that in addition to the victim's testimony, which prejudiced the defendant, we also have the corroborated testimony from the victim's own, from the defendant's own mother.
How does that fit with 404B? What was the factual relevancy of the prior conviction to the elements in this case?
This court has repeatedly said that sexual contact with a minor is a specific intent crime, and the state may introduce other acts evidence to establish that the touching was done with a requisite purpose to arouse or for some other form of sexual gratification. In this particular case, the defendant admitted to the touching and raised the issue of his intent by claiming that his actions that night were totally innocent and it was merely attempting to comfort his daughter. He argued extensively in his opening and closing statements that he was merely attempting to comfort and console his daughter because she was frightened, she was scared, and she asked him to give him a hug.
But isn't there a difference between the elements of the two crimes? The first part of 404B talks about that you may not admit evidence of other wrongs to prove the character or to show that he acted in conformity with
it. Right, and the jury
specifically what was done in this case?
No, the jury was specifically given a cautionary instruction and admonished that could not use or consider the evidence as proof of defendant's guilt. The evidence was introduced to rebut the defendant's purported defense that the victim, this was all a misunderstanding on her part, and that it was through no fault of his, and I quote in his opening and closing statements, she didn't know how to handle a loving hug. The defendant wanted to create an impression for the jury, and again, I quote, that the victim was a very disturbed child who didn't know how to trust men.
But how does it go to the question of identity?
Doesn't go to identity. Identity was an issue. It goes to the question of intent and absence of mistake.
I understood you correctly. You said earlier the court instructed the jury on all the reasons in 404B.
I believe it
included identity.
I could be wrong, but I believe the study shows the jury probably gave the standard pattern of jury instruction, which tracks the language of the statute with reference or sets out the admissible.
So if it gave this pattern, it just gave the jury all the reasons why it can be admitted, including identity and other reasons that have nothing to do with the case.
Right, but I believe the case specifically focused on intent and absence of mistake and or accident.
So you're saying that the more specific instruction directed the jury about what was the proper reason,
exactly,
even though it told the jury that it could consider it for identity and all those other reasons?
Right, it cautioned the jury that could not consider the evidence as proof of defendant's guilt. The jury instruction specifically said it could only be used to establish the absence of a mistake or accident.
But you see, there seems a conflict, though, in the instructions, because the jury can read one instruction, the broad one, saying we can consider it for the purpose of identity.
True, but I don't believe there's any indication in the record that the defendant objected to the instruction as given or proposed a separate instruction which would allegedly clarify the matter. In the specific case, in the findings of facts and conclusions of law, the trial court found that the evidence was not introduced to establish propensity, but rather went to pursue purposes. The first, according to the court, was to show an intent to have contact or sexual gratification. As I indicated earlier, specific sexual contact with a child is a specific intent crime, and the evidence in question which rebut the defendant's purported defense or failure defense as presented in his opening argument. That led to the trial court's finding that the evidence was also admissible to show that the contact by the defendant was not done by mistake or inadvertence. The court was finding the fact and conclusions Ross specifically said, a lack of mistake or inadvertence appears to be an issue given the comments he made to law enforcement. According to the court, there is evidence the defendant has been and will be presenting a defense that although he touched the victim in the evening in question, he did not do so with the intent to sexually arouse himself. Now, with regard to defendant's allegations that the prior incident was different or dissimilar, both factually and legally, from the present charge, as Justice Zimmer pointed out, it is well established that the degree of similarity required for other acts evidence depends on the purpose for which the evidence is offered.
Was there a motion hearing that actually went into the details of that other prior act before the court made any findings?
I believe there was a motion hearing as a reference to the state's motion to introduce the evidence, and there I believe the record clearly indicates that the incident question involved a situation where there's a party, alcohol is involved, and the defendant met a 15-year-old girl, and at some point during the party, he sees the girl lying naked on the bed. By his own admission, she's almost passed out. She's extremely intoxicated. The defendant nonetheless decided they'd abandon the situation and ask her to engage in sexual relations.
Well, you got to admit, there weren't a lot of facts that were similar to that prior case. So which ones are, other than it's a 15-year-old child?
Jack, exactly, he's the victim, and again,
that's about it.
But it's usually about the defense assertion that, hey, look, he's a loving father. He wouldn't touch the victim in that manner.
But, I mean, I can understand if the prior one dealt with a family member, but that wasn't the case, was it?
No.
So other than the age?
At that point, the only time the family member, given the fact that the defendant had been incarcerated for 10 years, at the time he was in the question, he only had two children. I believe at the time of his incarceration, the victim would have been approximately 4 or 5 years old. And again, even assuming for sake of argument that it can be said that the trial court erred in admitting the evidence, the defendant has to show prejudice. In order to establish prejudice, he has to show that absent the testimony in question, the jury probably would have returned a different verdict. The state would submit that given the victim's testimony regarding statements made by the defendant, asking her to take off her clothes so she can protect her younger sisters, trying to convince her that it's all right for parents to do bad things for her children, and promised her he would make her bedtime later if she would let him do this, along with the mother's testimony in reference to the criminal statements the defendant made in a letter, were more than sufficient to support the jury's verdict.
Well, didn't in the hearing on whether to admit it, the prosecutor, Mr. Ellingson, indicated that he really needed this evidence because he didn't have any other evidence of intent.
Exactly.
Specific intent.
Right.
So you're saying now he had plenty, so we shouldn't exclude the case.
No, I'm saying the only evidence that had specific intent is in reference to the defendant's prior inclination to have sex with minors. What I'm saying is reference to the victim's statements regarding, or excuse me, the victim's testimony regarding statements made to her by the defendant in the evening in question, along with the defendant's incriminating statements to her mother, were sufficient to support the verdict. The other issue the state would like to address is the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in allowing the state to introduce statements that he made while in prison that it was okay to have sex with children as long as it had their period. As indicated by defense counsel, it was the defendant's theory of position that such behavior was against man's law and not God's law. As I've already indicated, the trial court's evidentiary rulings are presumed correct. Questions involving the relevance of evidence are committed to the sound discretion of the trial court. Those decisions will not be reversed on appeal absent a clear abuse of discretion. Here, the state would submit that the defendant's trial tactics opened the door to the statements in question. As I indicated earlier, the defendant, in his opening statements, argued extensively to the jury that his actions that night were totally innocent, that his mother attempted to comfort and console his daughter because she was crying and asked him to give her a hug. His theory of the defense was that the victim simply misinterpreted that event. These statements shed light on that defense. And as for the alleged chilling effect that this court's ruling would have on the inmate's willingness to participate, The state would point out that that argument was not advanced at the trial court level and therefore has not been properly preserved for appeal.
That was never raised then?
At the trial court level, no.
Whether or not that was had any kind of protections?
Exactly. The review of the record reveals that the only argument advanced by defendant at the trial court level was, and I quote, "I don't think religion is relevant in this case, according to defendant. I think that sounds an awful lot like religious discussion that doesn't have any relevance at all in this case."
And that was a group of what, counsel? Would you call that a counseling session? Or what?
I believe it was a prison counselor along with a group of other inmates who were convicted or had a history of sex offenses.
And so it's part of their treatment and rehabilitation.
Exactly. Participation in the STAR program. Given that everyone is involved, there's no expectation of privacy implied or otherwise that those statements would be kept confidential and not subsequently disclosed. The last issue the state would like to briefly touch on is the defendant's argument that the trial court erred in not allowing him to cross-examine the victim regarding this 1998 incident of sexual abuse involving her uncle. The record reflects that although questioning the potential relevance of the evidence, the trial court did allow the defendant to question the victim regarding a subsequent 2008 incident involving this Obang Ojala, who was subsequently convicted and sentenced to prison. Specifically with regards to the 1998 incident, the court indicated, and I quote, "The victim would have been approximately only 4 or 5 years of age, and there's no indicia of falsehood or a pattern of false statements. In the court's view, it simply couldn't see the relevance due to its age as well as the victim's very young age at that point in time. As found by the court, the incident was simply too remote in time to be relevant. In order to establish prejudice from the trial court's limitation of cross-examination, the defendant must show that had he been allowed to cross-examine the victim regarding the 1998 incident, it would have had a significantly different impression on the jury with regard to the victim's credibility. The defendant argues that somehow this 1998 incident would have inevitably colored how she perceived the defendant's activities on the night in question, and would have therefore made her somewhat susceptible to oversensitivity. The state, however, would submit that being groped by the defendant, being told by the defendant to take off her clothes, and it's okay for parents to do bad things to their children, had nothing whatsoever to do with the victim being overly sensitive. Now, unless there are any further questions from the court, the state would close by asking the court to confirm the defendant's conviction in all respects.
Thank you, Mr. Gagan. Mr. Pizal, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Just a few issues that I would like to address and correct with respect to counsel for the state's arguments. First and foremost, with respect to the age of the alleged victim in this case, she was 13 years old on February 19th of 2009. She was 14 at the time of trial. The alleged victim in the 1999 conviction was 15.
And it was the 1999 that was consensual?
Yes.
And it was actually sexual, more than sexual contact?
Yes. In that case, it was a rape conviction. He had sex with a person who was legally incapable of giving consent. That's one of the issues we raised in the brief. The intent is not an issue, not an element of the rape conviction. So we question whether or not that rape conviction can be used as was attempted by the state in this case, to prove intent.
So there's been confusion here about the instructions that the court gave. Did the court then give the whole encompassing instruction to the jury at the end that it can be used for intent, mistake, identity, all that, or you don't remember?
Justice Myra Henry, I'm working from memory, but as I recall, there wasn't an all-encompassing instruction. It would be in the record, but I can't say for sure.
There's some, bits and pieces, and I don't have the jury instruction, that seems to indicate that the court at some point did include the whole thing. I mean, in his findings and stuff.
I believe that's correct. One of the problems that we have with
kind of, we've been trying to say that they have to limit, the prosecutor has to limit it to what it is that they're requesting it for in 404B, and also the court needs to limit the instruction to that so that it doesn't just come in over some general, we've said that over the years.
Absolutely, and that's further compounded by other issues at the trial level, such as I think the findings and conclusions that were written were actually issued after the trial date.
And they're very general. There's not anything specific in those findings about similarities other than a general statement that it was a similar crime.
That's correct, Your Honor. Another trouble that we ran into with the trial was that the issue was raised with Tracy Armstrong, the mother, who described the prior offense not as a statutory rape, but as, I think her exact words were, child molestation. And obviously we didn't want to flag that for the jury, so nothing was said. The issue was simply dropped to the credit.
Did you object to the 404B instructions?
The 404B instructions?
Yes.
No, they seem to be an accurate reflection of the law following the court's ruling that the evidence would be admitted. Our objection was limited to the inadmissibility of the evidence on grounds of lack of relevance, prejudice, and essentially the fact that it's character. And that's what all of this really boils down to, is you've got unconnected incidents and unconnected statements that basically are trying to paint Mr. Armstrong as a bad guy and argue that because he's a bad guy, it's more likely that the alleged victim is interpreting this correctly.
How do you address the argument made by the counsel for the state that even considering that this evidence may have been admitted in error, there was still enough evidence to convict your client, so he was not prejudiced?
Well, it's impossible to predict what the jury would have done. However, I think there's a number of cases, Chamley included, which sort of stand for the principle that prior acts evidence, particularly in sex crime cases, is always going to be prejudicial to the case. It may not necessarily be something you can prove that the jury would have ruled differently, but the jury certainly would have looked at the case differently if that evidence had been excluded and the incident on February 19th was considered only on the facts surrounding February 19th.
How did it actually come into evidence? How was it presented? By
which item?
The prior crime and the prior conviction. How did that actually get introduced?
That was raised through the testimony of several different witnesses. If I remember correctly, it was initially raised the existence of the conviction was raised through the alleged victim's testimony when she said, yes, my father was in prison. The nature of the conviction was, I think, first addressed when her mother was called to the stand and described the offense as child molestation. It wasn't until later
Did you object to that?
We didn't object to that statement when it came out. The full details didn't really come before the jury until later when we had the counselor and the assistant that conducted the psychosexual ABLE assessment who described how he was in prison and what he was in prison for.
And he pled guilty to that prior one?
Yes. Yes, he pled guilty to the 1999 conviction. Essentially, Justices, I have nothing further to argue at this point. If there are any further questions, I would be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'll take my seat.
Thank you, Mr. Peasall. No one's ever chastised for quitting early. Court will be in recess until 11 o'clock.